America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
This episode of Astronomy Cast is brought to you by Swinburne Astronomy Online, the world's longest-running online astronomy degree program. Visit astronomy.swin.edu.au for more information.
This time.
Astronomy Cast, episode 199 for Monday, September 20th, 2010. The Voyager Program. Welcome to Astronomy Cast, our weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. My name is Fraser Kane. I'm the publisher of Universe Today, and with me is Dr. Pamela Gay, a professor at Southern Illinois University, Evansville. Hi, Pamela. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Fraser?
Great. 199. That's really close to 200.
Yes, it is.
I know a lot of people want us to do something special for 200. I don't know. No, we'll have to think of something.
Yeah.
Either that or you can just explain how to do gravitational mathematics. Everyone get a piece of pen and paper out. All right.
No, there are some things I like myself too much to do, and explaining tensor calculus falls into that category.
Yeah, over the radio.
Over the radio, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So, launched in 1977, the twin Voyager spacecraft were sent to explore the outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Because of a unique alignment of the planets, Voyager 2 was the first spacecraft to ever make a close approach to Uranus and Neptune. Let's take a look back at this amazing program and see where the spacecraft are today. I wanted to add that are today because they're still going.
I know. Yeah. It's amazing. These missions are almost as old as we are.
Yeah.
And they're still sending back data, yeah. And we can still send them new commands. It's a two-way conversation still going on.
All right, well, let's not get ahead of ourselves then. Okay, so let's go back to the original concept and talk about, I guess we want to talk a bit about even the missions that came before the Voyagers first, the Mariners and the Pioneers.
So the Pioneers were two simple probes sent out to fly through the outer solar system. And they were spin stabilized. They were the most advanced things of their time. But they had limited cameras, they had limited instruments, and they didn't make extremely close approaches to the planets that they went to. And in the nature of the Mariner missions, where we had the early Mariners make very close approaches, sometimes even landing probes on Venus and Mercury and Mars and the inner planets, it was decided to do a pair of Mariner missions to Jupiter and Saturn. But along the way, these last two Mariner missions got renamed the Voyager 1 and 2 missions.
Right. There were many Mariners, as you said. There was ones that went to Venus and Mercury, Mars, some failed missions. And so they decided to rename these last two the Voyagers.
Right. And these two missions took advantage of a once in every 175-year alignment of the outer planets. Every once in a while, you get Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune lined up just right so that using gravitational assists, allowing your spacecraft to be tugged toward a planet that's orbiting in the direction your mission is going, you can add to your mission the velocity of that planet using gravitational assist. And with this once in every 175-year alignment, they were able to gravitationally assist their missions forward at each planet sequentially. And this meant that instead of taking 30 years, the mission could be condensed down to 12 years with this added gravitational acceleration.
We've talked a bit about this, like with some of the missions to Mars, right? Is that you don't just point your spacecraft at the target, fire the thrusters, and away you go. And then a little while later, you arrive at your destination. You have to go in a elliptical orbit similar, like that is just larger than the orbit of the Earth, and you sort of spiral outward from the Earth. If it's quick, you make it to Mars. You know, and if it's a much further planet, like, you know, the outer planets, I mean, Neptune, it's quite a big spiraling journey that you have to take.
Right. Angular momentum is a word I shouldn't say when small children might be listening.
Right. And it's rough. We have to deal... Angular momentum is rough.
Yes.
It's trouble.
And we have to deal with angular momentum. We have to deal with the energy necessary to move from one orbit to another. It's an energetic process. And when you can use something other than the chemicals you carry with you to accelerate yourself, it can make the journey a whole lot easier. And Voyager 1 and 2, when they were designed, the scientists, they took advantage of every bit of gravity they could. And the thing that amazes me is the scientists, they were clever in a lot of ways, because they were told, no, it's way too hard to build a spacecraft that will last more than 5 years. You guys are only going to Saturn and Jupiter. Hold yourselves back. Congress was holding them back, reining them in. But the scientists, nonetheless, knowing they were only supposed to go to Jupiter and Saturn, they still built the spacecraft prepared, ready, and launched in time to be able to make those additional journeys to the outer two planets.
I can just imagine, you know, you pass Saturn and you ask your missionary, hey, would you like us to go to Uranus? We could, you know, wouldn't be that hard. Okay, let's do that.
And what's amazing is they actually could have gone on to Pluto from Neptune if they wanted to, but they made the decision that visiting Neptune's moon Triton was much more scientifically immediate and interesting and certain to get good results. So they varied the spacecraft's trajectory to allow a close-by approach with Triton rather than continuing on to Pluto. Right. A similar decision was made when they were at Saturn.
That's right, yeah, with Titan.
Right. So apparently moons that begin with the letter T change trajectories of Voyager missions. So in both cases, they made the decision, well, we're going to forgo a little bit of future science just because we're not entirely sure our mission's going to keep going. But we're going to get immediate science right now and immediate awesome results. And they did.
Right. So Voyager 1 was unable to have the velocity change to make it out to Uranus because it made that close flyby of Titan and got sort of tweaked away from it on its path. So let's talk a bit about let's go back to 1977 and talk about the construction and launch of these rockets.
So back in 1977, back when I was a whole whopping 3 years old, these missions were launched with Voyager 2 taking off first because it was the second one to get to Jupiter. So just like they sometimes do with Mars missions that are paired, the one that launches first isn't necessarily given the first number. It's the one that's going to get there first that's given the first number. So Voyager 2 took off and... it actually had a rather interesting heart attack-inducing takeoff. Voyager was launched on a Titan rocket with a Centaur booster on top. And it got a bit confused. The computers on board underwent something that I hadn't actually heard about before called robotic vertigo. It essentially...
Robots shouldn't look up when they're near tall buildings, right?
Yeah. Exactly. It's an awesome description. And basically what it means is the computer on board was happily monitoring everything during launch, keeping track of what was going on, and then had an, oh my God, what are you doing to me moment as it was undergoing these huge accelerations. And the navigation computer had a minor heart attack and thought that it was having sensor overload issues in deep space. And the computers had been programmed to do all sorts of things in case sensors went wrong, in case they started tumbling. And luckily, Voyager didn't have control of its own thrusters at that moment, or something really bad could have happened. The Centaur was luckily still in control of Voyager's thrusters. So Voyager sorted itself out. It successfully separated away from the Centaur booster. Everything was going fine. And then it had another, I'm near the Earth. I really don't know where I am, actually. I'm going to stop all communications with the planet Earth. Freak out moment again. For 79 minutes, it locked itself down, went into a careful series of basically ballet moves to find the sun, reorient itself. And one of the things that they did when they programmed these missions was they knew that most likely, if one of these missions had a freakout moment, it would probably be while it was in the outermost parts of our solar system. Right now, where these two missions are, it takes 12 hours for a radio signal to go from Earth out to either Voyager 1 or Voyager 2. And if a mission's having a freakout moment, it can't have its first thing be, I'm going to use up a whole bunch of electricity and call to the planet Earth and ask for help. What they programmed to do instead was shut down all communications, figure out where they're pointed, reorient themselves, refind Earth, and then reestablish communications. So here the poor folks are on Earth with their mission seconds of communications away from the planet, watching it undergo shutdown, reorientation, figure itself out. It finally radio back to Earth and started operating normally. And it's behaved beautifully ever since, but the first few hours of this mission, I think, caused a lot of hair loss.
When you report on this stuff, I mean, we find with the universe today, there's a lot of this that goes on that I don't think people really realize with many of the missions. You know, shortly after launch, as it's about to, they'll go into shutdown procedures. Things will malfunction. There's a lot of really interesting stories behind the scenes that go on as the scientists are wrestling with the issues that are coming up. When you look at it from the big picture, like, oh, a bunch of beautiful photographs and a neat story about the mission. But you know, the day to day, as we report on them, you know, we report on such and such mission has gone into shutdown mode, or, you know, this one is offline, you know, controllers, and eventually they can't reach them anymore. So,
right.
Yeah, you know, this happens a lot. Or, you know, this gyroscope has failed and that antenna refuses to open. Yeah, it's a lot of this.
And this is where we're really lucky that pretty much everything is built with redundant systems. And we really rely on these redundant systems to allow the missions to carry on. Occasionally, we end up having to figure out, okay, so we lost the main transmitter. I believe it was Galileo that we had that problem with.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
all of the sudden, you have to figure out, okay, I need new compression techniques for all these amazing images. And they reprogram these satellites on the fly, which is about the most terrifying thing I can imagine as a programmer.
Oh, yeah.
But they worked. They made it to Jupiter. They made it to Saturn. And then they kept going.
So then Voyager 2 launches. And then shortly after that, Voyager 1 launches. But Voyager 1 beats it to Jupiter.
Right. And when Voyager 1 got to Jupiter, it made a whole series of discoveries, from seeing Jupiter's rings to being able to finally see the Great Red Spot as this spinning hurricane in turbulent bands, to, well, the lava flows on Io. And this for me is kind of one of those touchstone moments. So I was all of four when Voyager 1 got to Jupiter. And I can still remember being made to take a nap so that I could stay up and watch the data coming back and being
really
reported on TV.
I did not have that aggressive a parent on that front. I got to say, I was woken up to watch the space shuttle launch in 1981. Uh-huh. But I was not ready for the real-time data coming back from the Voyagers.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah, but I will for my kids. I mean, you know, when New Horizons arrives at Pluto, we are going to be right there when it happens.
But your kids are going to be a bit older, so they won't require the naps at that stage.
That's true, yeah. Now, this isn't the first time the spacecraft has gone to Jupiter, so it's not completely momentous.
No, but this was the highest resolution images that we'd had to date. New moons were being found, new belts were being found. And the fact that Io had volcanism, that was a completely new discovery. We really hadn't realized either how dangerous the radiation belt environment around the Jovian system was, or that there was volcanoes on a moon of all crazy places to find lava. Mm-hmm. So neither Pioneer 10 or 11 had seen this volcanic activity.
Voyager 1 arrives. Voyager 2 comes after.
Voyager 2 comes later. And so some of the cooler stuff had already been discovered. But it did make an even closer approach. It discovered a few new rings around Jupiter, and then it continued to observe the volcanic activity around Io.
And Jupiter is not a safe planet to make a close flyby on.
No, no. Yeah, that would be an understatement. So you have, first of all, giant gravity well. So those are always challenging to deal with. One of the things that kind of got me is our space shuttle orbits about 300 miles up. And the Voyager missions, they were making approaches about 1,000 times greater than that from the surface of the two planets. So we had Voyager 2 getting within about 350,000 miles of the cloud tops of Jupiter. That's a pretty good distance. And Voyager 1, sorry, it did make the closer approach, not Voyager 2. Voyager 1 came within about 217,000 miles of the cloud tops. So that's a pretty good distance, but when you start considering the significant gravity well that you're dealing with Jupiter, so you're maneuvering through a big gravity well, then you're maneuvering around a giant radiation field where you have to worry about these arcing belts of radiation that are in part responsible for creating plasma belts and all sorts of other insane high-energy events that are amazing to look at with our orbiting observatories locally. Then you have to deal with the high gravity from these different moons. These are moons that compete with planets for a place on the mass weighing scale of our solar system.
And I know that the Voyagers really helped make the big discovery on Europa.
Right. So it was Voyager 2 that took the beautiful images of Europa that revealed all these intersecting linear features that we think come from the tidal forces just basically squishing Europa like a squishy ball in a way that causes it to have liquid water and a constantly cracking icy surface that lets some of this water ooze out and refreeze. So they'd been seen in low resolution photos of Voyager 1, but it was with Voyager 2 and its closer high resolution photos that we were able to have this, wow, that's weird. What is that approach that we've been trying to sort out for all the decades since?
And I know that Voyager really helped, you know, conclusively understand what the Great Red Spot was.
Right. The hurricane, it was finally able to see all of the eddies and the storms, and we still don't know what caused it. We can recreate it in some simulations, but different people still come up with different results. But it was clearly some sort of a hurricane as seen with these missions.
All of these discoveries, I mean, we just take them all as the rules, as the laws these days. But you can think about it, you know, some of these things were completely unexpected. Hey, well, volcanoes on Io, what's that all about? So now, right. You know, now we're so used to them. But these are the times when these discoveries were first made. It's quite impressive. So the spacecraft, you know, and I know they turned up a couple of moons, more moons around Jupiter as well.
Right.
And then out to Saturn.
Right. So here we have Voyager 1 takes off and it made its Saturn flyby in November of 1980. And here, all of a sudden, we're realizing, oh my gosh, Titan has an atmosphere. This was, again, one of those weird, we knew it was there because of Pioneer 11, but we made the decision with Voyager 1 to get up close and personal and take a detailed look at this strange methane atmosphere, trying to figure out how is it that this moon is now behaving like a planet. And so this is where Voyager 1 at this point could have gone on to see Pluto. But the decision was made to steer it so that it came down, looked down on the plane of the disks. So this is where we get these beautiful images showing the shadow of Saturn cutting across the rings of Saturn. And then to make a close approach that allowed us to see the sunlight passing through and getting absorbed by Titan's thick atmosphere. These are just some of the most amazing images that we had up until Cassini went and returned. We were also starting to find new rings. Voyager 1 took images of Saturn's F ring, bringing us new moons, new understanding.
You can see, once again, that progression, right? The Pioneer turned up a hint of an atmosphere in Titan. Voyager 1 was retasked to go close to Titan to really get a look at it. And then Cassini was sent with a probe designed to land on Titan, and it had the instruments to actually peer right through its atmosphere and see, you know, rivers and lakes of hydrocarbons on the surface of the moon. So it's this progression. Each insight gives you further questions and comes up with new mission profiles that need to then be developed and sent.
And this is where you see science really as a way of telling the story bit by bit. And It's a detective's novel where first you go in and you get your first clue and then you realize, well, I need to take this back to the lab and start using bigger instruments. Well, the lab instruments I have here aren't good enough. I need to send this out. Well, here, instead of doing on the site and then in the lab and then sent out investigations, we're simply sending the lab to the planet, and we're sending progressively more complicated labs to the planet to make more and more detailed investigations.
So Voyager 1 makes its fly past Titan, and now it's on a orbit that won't let it go past Uranus and Neptune. So it's kind of done the major part of its, you know, that's the last thing it's going to pass by. So it flies off, right?
But it did go on to do one really neat thing back in 1990. And here I'm in high school. To me, the story of Voyager is getting older and older and older. And hopefully it won't die before I do, because that would be sad. So Voyager 1 went on in 1990 to look back on our entire solar system. And it captured this fabulous series of images where it was able to make out all the planets in our solar system in this crazy, strange-shaped mosaic. And that was the last real set of images that we've had sent back to the Earth from this particular mission.
Right. And one of the most famous images on that is what Carl Sagan called the pale blue dot.
Right. And he wrote this amazing essay that everyone needs to go look up, where he related his thoughts about this, because here you basically have the Earth just shining through a sunbeam. And what he wrote was, from this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam.
That's only just a piece of it. There's actually a longer essay. So it's highly recommended that you dig it up. Just do a search for pale blue dot and in fact, the book too. That was one of the most influential books for me for space exploration and astronomy was Pale Blue Dot by Carl Sagan. So I highly recommend, if you haven't already, find that book and read it.
And Carl Sagan's life was deeply wound up with these two missions. Both Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 carried on them these gold records that much to the chagrin of many, have etchings of nude human forms on them. They were actually banned from putting naked pictures of people on to explain humanity because that was considered wrong. And they contain sound samples, everything from the beating of a human heart to music of a myriad of different cultures to people saying hello in all the languages of the world that they could easily get access to people saying hello in.
And detailed instructions for the alien invaders to come and destroy our planet.
Right. No, that is one of the arguments, is it does lay out our placement in the solar system using easy to follow, if you have mathematical understanding, definitions of where we are based on pulsars. So yeah, it contains a lot of information that includes how to find us and what we look right. like, but it's also a message of peace.
But I mean, theoretically, these are made of gold, right?
Right.
And you know, there's not a lot happening in space except for, you know, micrometeorites and cosmic rays. So these could last for billions of years.
These are time capsules. And while neither of the Voyager missions is pointed at a star and space is, well, mostly empty, the probability that either Voyager mission is actually going to get scooped up by an alien randomly finding it in the galaxy is fairly close to zero. But fairly close and zero aren't the exact same thing. So it could be what we did was we sent out a time capsule that will be the ones to find someday. And some of you may now be thinking back to the Star Trek movies.
V'ger.
Right. Star Trek, the motion picture, one of the most horrible things ever done to that series. That was actually Voyager 7, which doesn't exist. Mm. So what happened in that movie won't actually happen. But the idea that we'll be the ones to find our own probe and be able to look back on ourselves, that might actually not be too unrealistic. And it's kind of cool to think about.
So when last we saw our heroes, Voyager 1 had taken this beautiful mosaic of the whole solar system. Voyager 2 had not made a suicidal flyby through Titan's atmosphere and so was on target to reach Uranus.
And it wasn't suicidal. It was just misdirection.
Sure. A sacrificial
orbit. Yes, we could go with that.
A sacrificial trajectory. So Voyager 2 kept going.
Right. So Voyager 2 went on. It did an encounter with Uranus.
Now, this is the first time a spacecraft has ever been, first and last time, by the time we're recording right. this, that a spacecraft has ever been to Uranus.
And so here we are. We're discovering previously unknown moons, which is pretty cool. And it got to study this weirdo planet that's turned on its side, orbiting with a tilt of slightly more than 90 degrees. And It still looked like a pale blue dot of nothing. But hey, it got examined up close. And we looked at the Uranian ring system. And Uranus has one of the weirdest ring systems in the solar system because it appears to be a brand new one in a lot of ways. It just doesn't have the same albedos, the same anything as other ring systems. But I think the coolest thing that was found while they were at Uranus, while Voyager 2 was at Uranus, is the moon Miranda, which basically looks like a moon that had a really, really bad day and then gravitationally pulled itself back together without asking a planetary surgeon to put on a good face.
Yeah, it got a beat down for sure.
Yeah.
And then, so that was 1986, and I definitely, I can remember that, you know, I was in high school, and it was all in the news, and on the paper, and on TV, and we got to see right. these first pictures. And in fact, I had a copy of this old book, I think it was from like Time Life or National Geographic, called The Universe, Our Universe, had the spaceship on the front. I absolutely loved it. And they came out with a new version a few years later, once those photos were in, that they could put in the pictures from Uranus and Neptune, a new edition. But yeah, I remember 86 was Uranus. And then 3 years later.
3 years later, August of 1989, Neptune. So now all the planets, although we didn't know it was all the planets at the time, all the planets at that point had finally been visited by a NASA mission. And here it was made the decision that, well, we're going to call it good after visiting Triton. And so they explored this last system and decided to pass over the North Pole of Triton and go on out of the disk of the galaxy. And here, I think probably the coolest discovery was the great dark spot on Neptune. It's since gone away, but it was there then, and that was kind of cool. We now think that this might have been actually a hole in the cloud deck of Neptune that allowed us to see down to darker layers. We're not sure, and we're waiting to see what happens as we watch Neptune pass through another orbit and pass through another set of weather seasons.
And as we said right at the beginning of the show, these spacecraft are both still going, they're still functioning, and scientists can still communicate with them.
And back in May, we actually, as a field, had a moment of, oh my God, hold your breath, because one of the two Voyager missions started sending back kind of weirdo data. It turned out that one of the bits in its memory had gone bad, and they last May reprogrammed it to be able to send back healthy data again. So we're still undergoing this two-way communications, keeping both missions going, and we're periodically shutting off different instruments just because they draw too much power, and the power supplies on these missions are winding down over time, but they are still going, and that's pretty amazing.
And there's still a little bit of science to be done out there.
Right. They're still measuring all sorts of different things using their non-imaging instruments. So the operational instruments that we have right now are looking at magnetic fields or looking at low energy charged particles. On Voyager 1, we still have a plasma investigator. There's still cosmic ray detections going on. There's still plasma wave investigations going on. So science data is still getting returned.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the big questions is, where does the sun's influence, you know, hit the galaxy's sort of background particles? You know, this is the heliosphere, right, where the solar wind bumps up against the galaxy.
So right now, the missions are what are in, we're calling the heliosheath. This is where the heliopause starts to get slowed down by interactions with the interstellar media. And unfortunately, the particle counters on the missions are no longer powered up. But they're able to figure out, by looking at the responses from all the other instruments, roughly where they are. And they'll be able to tell when they actually leave our solar system. And it looks like they're still going to be giving data when that happens.
Hmm. Well, I think for me, the Voyagers are, for, you know, in my lifetime, and I know for a lot of our listeners, they were alive when the Apollo missions happened. You know, that was before my time, or I was, you know, one and two when the final Apollo missions happened. So I just don't remember them. But the Voyagers were there, the launch when I was a kid, and the big discoveries when I was a teenager. And even now, I mean, it's funny, as I, you know, lead my career writing about space and astronomy, we still have a story or two a year about the Voyagers and the latest discoveries. So it's been a constant companion. The writings of Carl Sagan really reinforce that. Star Trek 1, you know.
no, that doesn't influence anything.
So it's great. And I think for me, the Voyagers anyway were my Apollo. They were the most influential missions on me, in getting me really excited and interested in space exploration and astronomy. So a big thank you to anyone who worked on the Voyagers, who's listening to this. I really appreciate everything you did.
And please keep them going. And thank you, NASA, for upgrading the big ear so that we could keep listening on what these missions are doing.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Pamela. And we'll talk to you next time.
Sounds good. Talk to you later.
This has been Astronomy Cast, a weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos. Show notes and transcripts for every episode are available on our website. Check it out at astronomycast.com. You can send us any comments, questions, or feedback to info@astronomycast.com. We read every email. The show is a nonprofit educational resource provided by Fraser Cain and Dr. Pamela Gay. We're supported through the kind donations of listeners like you. If you enjoy Astronomy Cast, why not give us a donation? It helps us pay for bandwidth, transcripts, and show notes. Just click the donate link on the website. All donations are tax deductible for U.S. taxpayers. You can support the show for free, too. Write a review or recommend it to your friends. Every little bit helps. Click Support the Show on our website to see some suggestions. To subscribe to the show, point your podcatching software at astronomycast.com/podcast.xml or subscribe directly from iTunes. Music is provided by Travis Searle. The show was edited by Preston Gibson. Astronomy Cast is produced at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville with generous support from Universe Today.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.